Welcome to the Maria Heller Show. On the net since 2000 and still going strong. If you feel like you're not getting the real news, if you feel like you're not connected spiritually, you have found your home. Maria covers a wide range of topics as only a snarky New Yorker can. Straight up, no chaser. No censorship, no corporate sponsors, thus true freedom of speech. Your subscription gives you unlimited access as a member of the smartest audience on earth. Relax and enjoy the education. Now here's Maria.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to the show. Today I have a man back on the show. He's been here before. And it's exciting news because for all of you that did indeed listen to the interview on the excellent book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA's murderous targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and other activists, John Potash, he's also now has a fabulous two-hour film on drugs as weapons against us. So I'm happy to have John back with me. Good morning, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me back again, Maria. It's great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, I watched the movie last night. I actually invited one of my friends over to watch it with me. And, you know, many months ago, I don't remember how long ago it was that you sent me your book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. After I read it, I passed it along to her. And honestly, it changed her life. She read every word in the book, and now she looks at the world in totally open eyes. And she watched the film with me. She also thought the film was excellent. And she just kept bragging about how much she loves the book. So I wanted to share that with you.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Marie.
Well, you know, that's my thing. I try to educate people because if people don't know the real history of America, if they don't know the real history of the supposed war of drugs, I like to call it, they won't understand what's going on in the current world where we are now, after economically stripping and sanctioning Venezuela, looks like we want to go back into Venezuela. So when you covered the part about Venezuela and the drugs back in the day, I just said to myself, there's never anything new. So interesting days we live in, indeed.
Yeah, no doubt.
John, what prompted you to make this into a movie?
Well, I basically just think that a lot of people aren't reading as much. And, you know, even in the book, it looks long, being about 430 pages, but a lot of it's pictures and then notes. And so the real content to read isn't that long. But, you know, people are so busy these days, they don't necessarily have time to read. And so I thought I'd give it to them in a shorter, quicker version, which, you know, is really about 60 pages of script in a two-hour movie, but basically condenses all of the elements of Drugs as Weapons Against Us, you know, in that movie. And hearing it from the horse's mouth, hearing it from CIA whistleblowers, FBI whistleblowers, you know, top experts like the president of the American Pathological Association, and, you know, different other people, some of the police officers that investigated some of these stories, all say what they say in my film. And so it's good just for people to hear it directly from the sources and see the sources more directly and hear it from some of these musicians' mouths, you know, what was going on in their lives at that time.
Right, right. Well, you know, I was pleased to see you include Dave McGowan in the video.
Of course.
You know, and I saw Dave's face on the screen. I said, Dave, but...
Yeah.
You know, his work, you know, Weird Scenes inside the Canyon, you know, so many great people that you had, you know, in the movie. And I was so happy to see it. It was much more pleasurable than the book, because the book was a deep read and I enjoyed every second of it. But what I found was, you know, it made it easier for me. I liked seeing the video. I liked seeing the video of Kurt Cobain, you know, another story that went away. And, you know, I was watching my friend's face while all that was happening, and I could just see her reaction. And I think it's something that everybody needs to see. Now, before we get into the meat of the story, let my listeners know how they can see the film. I mean, sure. I watched it on Vimeo, so How else are people going to be able to access the film or get themselves a copy? Because this is one of those things you invite some friends over and watch it with them.
Yeah, so media like yourself got in advance, but it's officially released on Tuesday, January 29th, this coming Tuesday. It will be officially released, and it will be available for rent on Vimeo, on Vudu, on Microsoft Xbox, on iTunes, and I don't even know some of these places like iTunes and Microsoft Xbox that well, but Google Play, YouTube Rent, they're popular amongst younger people,
right.
I guess.
Right, Amazon,
so
Best
I
Buy.
I have video and Vimeo on my TV, but you can also buy it, and if you buy it, if you actually purchase it, you get the 16 extra minutes of deleted scenes, which I think were very hard to delete because I've got the death of Brian Jones in there, which I actually was very tough for me to cut out of the regular movie, and that's a pretty amazing part of the movie because he said I have A.E. Hotchner, Ernest Hemingway's longtime editor, saying in his book that Brian Jones had talked to Jimi Hendrix and John Lennon, and they were seriously considering forming a supergroup with him right before Brian Jones died. And that was part of the reason I think he was killed, murdered by U.S. and British intelligence. But so I have that, the deleted scenes like that in there, a hypnotist who had admitted that he, could use drugs and hypnosis to get people to do whatever he wanted to do. And he was a CIA hypnotist who admitted being involved with Sirhan and killing, using him, hypnotizing him to, getting rid of RFK, And so a lot of good stuff in deleted scenes. And so I hope people buy it from either Best Buy or from Amazon or from Barnes & Noble because you can purchase the film there. And that's some of the places you can get it.
Right. Well, one of the big stories lately in the news is about the Sackler family and their OxyContin and how they lied about it, how they knew it was going to be addictive, et cetera. Now they'll be, the family's being investigated and it looks like, they might be going down the tubes. But when you look at that and you look at your book, which shows you pretty much drugs make the world go round, I don't know how else to say it, and how long this has been going on. It's really crazy, and to me, it kind of really explains so much about what's gone wrong in the United States.
Yeah. I'm so sorry, Maria, about my dog. Can you hold on 1 second?
Sure.
Janine, can you get Dojo? Sorry about that. Maria.
That's all right. It reminds me of...
Dogs barking at delivery.
It reminds me of when I used to interview McGowan. He always had his dog that he loved so much in the background barking. I just thought it added authenticity.
Thanks. Yeah, it's hard to even talk about Dave. It's just so sad to even talk about Dave. But I do want to talk more about Dave and his great work. I'm glad you keep bringing him up. So you were just asking about, about the Sackler family and the opioid issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad they're getting in trouble for what they did. But on the other hand, right, drugs, as I document, drugs have made the world go round, sadly enough. And obviously so many doctors were just in secondhand kind of guilty in this whole situation with pushing, these opiates on so many young people, so many different people that end up developing addictions. And so many other people like the government, FDA and whoever else who allowed this family to get this drug, this OxyContin and whatever other drugs, painkillers out there and getting people addicted are also, partly guilty of all this stuff. And so, and I think, in the big picture, obviously the people, they knew what was going on, and they knew that so many, and I counsel so many people that have gotten addicted to heroin after developing, getting hurt, getting pain pills pushed on them, and then developing an addiction to the pain pills that turned into a heroin addiction.
Right. Well, you have that side of it, but then you have the other side of it, where the CIA imports the drugs, releases them in predominantly black neighborhoods, or tricks activists somehow or another are getting hooked on these drugs. And basically, that's how they killed the anti-war movement in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm watching, when I was watching the film, you know, you talk about, you know, the Pierponts and, you know, all those big names, the Morgans, et cetera. And I paused the film and I looked at my girlfriend and I said to her, you know, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, down by Brooklyn Heights, all those streets of the most expensive property in Brooklyn were named after these criminals as if they were heroes,
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah. These guys, these biggest families, these wealthiest families definitely got their start with that opium shipping, you know, with the British elites, you know, with the British East India Company, and founded the Ivy League schools on opium money, you know. And I, you know, I've got that top selling author of, you know, in the film talking about how he went from, you know, New York Times bestseller that was made into a Clint Eastwood movie, Flags of Our Fathers, and his next book was incredibly radical, actually, because all he did was just follow the trail in a book about called The Imperial Cruise, about how all these families were involved in this opium shipping and started these Ivy League schools with their huge wealth made off of opium shipping. And they never left that. You know, they of course kept a hand in that because it was so lucrative, you know, especially when it was illegal, and it made even more money in the black market with the opium and the heroin and all that. And so that's why, you know, we end up seeing this today of the Vietnam War and the, you know, Afghan War being the two longest wars in U.S. history, and what happens to be there. You know, wars are always over resources.
Right.
And so they're over the opium fields. But as you just said, and it's also about why do they want this so much? Not only do they make a lot of money off it, but such a good tool for social control, because when you get all this heroin into all these, you know, inner city neighborhoods and stuff, you develop so many problems. It's not just about the people that get addicted, it's about the families that are stuck with the addict, and the whole community ends up being in having it really hard with all these addicts in the neighborhood and all the drug dealing going on, and the way it just ruins the whole community.
Right. And, you know, when they call it a war on drugs, they really mean a war of drugs is more like it.
Yeah.
You know, well, what's interesting is, you know, you also showed in the movie that still two of the biggest banks in the world really started out as drug dealers and money launderers, and probably are still doing the same.
Right. Yeah, it's the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation is supposed to be the largest bank in Europe. You know, it's an English bank, and it started just a few years after the second opium war on China. And that was England's war against China just to force, you know, opium into their country. Mm-hmm. And so they started on that. Meanwhile, but the J.P. Morgan Chase banks were the Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan families. And, the you know, Morgan's, of course, it's John Pierpont Morgan, and Pierpont's had intermarried with the Russells, who were the biggest opium shipping family in the United States,
mm-hmm.
who were involved with the British East India Company. And, of course, they helped found Yale and funded Skull and Bones. The Russell Trust funded Skull and Bones. So, yes, there's so much involved. And so many of the Rockefellers and Morgans and all went to some of these Ivy League schools, but particularly Yale, and were involved in Skull and Bones, and got the equivalent of about $230,000 upon graduation when they graduated from Yale and Skull and Bones. That was given to each member of Skull and Bones when they graduated. So they were the beneficiaries of this, you know, incredible opium money.
Right. And then when you look at those same names, those are the same people that were involved in the criminal creation of the Federal Reserve Bank.
Yeah.
So here they've got the drugs, here they've got the money, here they've got the banks, and if that wasn't bad enough, they seem to have been involved in a lot of eugenics programs.
Right. And for people that don't know, the Chase Bank was owned by the Rockefeller family and started by them, and of course J.P. Morgan says, you know, is the self-name. But so back before World War II, they were the primary funders. Them and the Carnegies were the primary funders of the eugenics movement, of the eugenics office, the eugenics movement, and it was like the most racist, genocidal movement in this country's history. I mean, just maybe, you know, arguably except after, you know, of course, the genocide of the American Indian movement was unbelievable, but, you know, and it was active. They passed, they were so powerful, they got laws passed in over half the states in the country for sterilization of people they, you know, considered genetically inferior. And that included, they called 90% of blacks genetically inferior. They called about 60% of Jews genetically inferior, even 60% of immigrant Catholics genetically inferior.
Italians.
Even poor white Anglo-Saxon Protestants were considered often, you know, imbecilic and inferior, just, you know, because they were poor. It's incredible what that movement was about, and award-winning syndicated columnist Edwin Black does a great job of documenting all that with his incredible book War Against the Weak, which has been translated into dozens of different languages around the world. But it was really something, and he showed how that movement and all those incredibly wealthy families then funded the rise of Hitler and the rise of the Nazis.
Right.
And then after World War II, they then harbored thousands and thousands of Nazis that they put in, they used in the MKUltra program, which is really the CIA project. MKUltra was the use of drugs as weapons against us, testing dozens of drugs for use in that regard. And so, you know, it just shows the evolution of that movement into Project MKUltra and the harboring of Nazis in Latin America that created those cocaine trafficking routes.
Right. Well, you know, when you talk about MKUltra in the movie, when you talk about all the different operations from Operation Paperclip to Operation Artichoke, all I could say was, again, when I paused the movie and looked at my friend and I said to her, if they were doing this in the 50s and 60s, what do you think they're doing now?
Right. Yeah.
You know, for some reason, people have this this idea that their government would never hurt them or government wouldn't kill their own people. And that, you know, these, when we talk about these things, you know, these different operations and whatnot, they think that somehow they magically went away. Mm-hmm. But my thought is always, maybe I'm just that way, John. My thought is always, if they could do that then, what are they doing now?
No doubt. And Dave McGowan did a good job of documenting some of the ways that eugenics is still being carried on today with different names, you know, in different projects. And I think he did that in his book, Understanding the F Word.
Right.
You know, about fascism. And so he didn't, it's surprising, actually, he didn't even mention, you know, Edwin Black's book, but he mentions all these other great sources for how eugenics has appeared to continue up to today. And there's surely still things going on today that way. And I used to have that myth in my mind that things would generally get more progressive over time, but it just doesn't necessarily happen that way, sadly enough.
No, because drugs still run the world. You know, again, when you were covering Afghanistan under George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, after I looked at my friend and I said, another criminal that got a, you know, the funeral fit for a king. I looked at her and I said, well, why do you think we're still in Afghanistan? Yeah. And it's interesting because her stepson was a Marine in Afghanistan. And she said, I know. He sent me pictures of him just protecting the poppy fields.
Well, so she got pictures personally that way.
Right.
We see some of them in the film and we, you know, because I'm just drawn from mainstream media. But it's wild that she got them personally and that her son testified to her about that. Yeah.
Exactly. She said that's what they were doing because I met a bunch of those Marines when they came home on leave. And that's what they were doing in Afghanistan. And that's, you know, what is it now, 18 years that we've been there this time?
Yeah, it's incredible.
And if people think we're ever leaving, I mean, you know, people also have to realize that the major pharmaceutical companies need those drugs too.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they make their drugs out of.
Right.
But I was surprised. I think it was towards the end of the movie. And correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I was surprised to see that, maybe not so much surprised, but that the DEA pretty much backed the drug that I know a lot of people have used because they think it puts them in nirvana or euphoria, ecstasy.
Oh, yeah, that's very sad. Well, first I'll just let people know, if who don't know, that Afghanistan's called the Golden Crescent for opium fields, and the Golden Triangle for opium fields is Vietnam, of course, and so that's just a little bit of history that people may not understand about Afghanistan, but the and they actually lie at two ends of the same mountain range. It just so happens that opium grows best in that area of those two ends of the mountain range, same mountain range. But regarding ecstasy, yeah, it's you know, it really surprised me. Now, I sadly enough had a drug abuse problem in high school in the beginning of college, and I tried everything. I was lucky not to develop a full-fledged addiction, but I was very close to that. And so I still am upset that I ever, you know, that, you know, I used acid maybe half a dozen times, and I tried, you know, ecstasy at least twice. And but I realized that, you know, from reading all these studies on ecstasy, you know, doing counseling for a living now, and seeing so much evidence from my clients, reading and seeing all the studies from around the world, ecstasy is just so clear cut to hurt certain aspects of our memory and our brain functioning in that regard. And it's, you know, it's so sad that it's still being sold to us as something that's, you know, harmless.
Right, party drug.
In the form of Molly. They call it Molly these days, right. You know, and they call it other things. But so then you get, and so the DEA is now, like, you know, going backwards and saying, oh, well, maybe it can help people with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But as a counselor, I've been trained in the latest techniques. You know, I did a 50-hour training in something called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which doesn't involve any drugs. And it really is an incredibly effective new technique for PTSD. And there's another technique, I call it the recounting technique, which is incredibly effective for single episode traumas. And these techniques don't hurt the mind at all, whereas if you're going to try to use ecstasy for PTSD, you're going to hurt brain functioning. And it's
right.
Very sad that so many doctors are pushing these drugs, basically because these institutes, these Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, the Hefter Institute, and a third institute, whose name leaves me now, but it's a British institute founded by a woman who was part of the royalty, an aristocrat who actually pushed the idea of tree panning in the early 1970s, which is the idea that if you drill holes in your skull, you can expand your mind.
Right.
So she's out of her mind, obviously, but she has so much money that she can just push this institute, pretend like it's a legitimate institute that's you know, promoting good things with drugs. But her promotion of this tree panning was so popular in England and so ridiculous that actually influenced John Lennon to think that maybe he should try tree panning. It might be a good idea, because he was savvy enough hurt by the, you know, all the drug use and wasn't thinking properly at that time. This is about 1970 or so, according to a top biography of Lennon. But so back to the ecstasy, you know, I show the evidence that, you know, this head of chemical warfare in South Africa was found with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. His assistant said that he was ordered to create a ton of ecstasy, and then this guy Wouter Basson was caught, you know, trafficking it in the, you know, in the South African black neighborhoods during apartheid. And was he really trying to make them all happier and feel better and hurt, you know, and help their PTSD? No, he was trying to cause them some mild cerebral damage with this ecstasy. I mean, that's, you know, evident. And so I have him in the film, of course,
right,
admitting that he was working with the top chemical laboratories with U.S. intelligence in both England and the United States. So, yeah, I hope people, you know,
right,
learn from that.
Well, and then you talk about ecstasy creating memory loss. And, you know, again, I paused the film and I said, you know, we have an epidemic of dementia or what's the other word for it? I just went blank on it myself and I never did ecstasy.
Alzheimer's, another.
Alzheimer's, right.
Yeah.
And I was like, who knows how much of that is from the drugs that have been pushed on people for years?
Good point. Yeah.
You know, because my mind is always trying to make connections because, you know, people keep asking me, especially people outside of America, what's wrong with Americans? Why aren't they taking a stand? Why are they allowing this to happen in their country? And the other day I was, I did an interview with Bev Conover, the editor of Intrepid Report, which we've done for 20 years. And she talked about the dumbing down of America being complete. And of course that sparked in my head, the drugs have a large part to do with it. And people don't realize a lot of these drugs are in your air, in your water, and they're also in your food.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, the pollution and all that too. Yeah, it's really incredible how, yeah, I mean, yeah, just even the dumping of all these pharmaceutical drugs can do things to us too. But, and they're in our water supply that way. And,
right.
You know, studies have shown that, you know, of our water supply show how many of those things are in our water supply.
Right, they're inside the fish, they're inside the water. You know,
right.
when I was a kid, listen, everybody always said, when you have a leftover prescription, just flush it. Well, all that flushing, I think the last time I covered it, was a while ago, they said there were 22 pharmaceuticals in everybody's drinking water.
Right, right. Yeah, and so with the mildest of the street drugs, you know, weed, marijuana, I'm generally pro decriminalization, pro legalization for medical marijuana or medical uses, because I am hearing lots of accounts of good use of medical marijuana.
Right.
But sadly enough, I'm also hearing about everybody thinking, oh well, it's healthy, it's medicine, so let's not worry about our kids starting to smoke at age 11, 12, 13. The age of people first starting to smoke weed is dropping drastically, and when kids are smoking, you know, develop a regular habit at a young age, it's really hurting their grades, really hurting their schooling, really hurting their brain kind of development, sadly enough, and it's much easier for them to develop addictions when they start at a much earlier age, as studies find.
Well, I mean, you could, right.
That's a sad thing.
All right. Well, you know, you could clump that in. You know, for myself personally, I've always been pro-pot. I've never seen anybody addicted to marijuana, and I believe me, I've got 50 years plus invested in it. But I also don't believe anybody under 18 until their brains are developed should use it or cell phones.
That's the key, yeah.
Right. But you look at, you know, cell phones, you look at these pharmaceuticals, you look at that they're putting babies, toddlers on these antidepressant, antipsychotic drugs.
Right.
And none of those drugs have ever been tested or approved for people under 18. The damage your cell phone does to a developing brain, let alone the ones that are developed, because I know a lot of people that ended up with tumors behind their ear of whatever ear they use on their cell phone. So I would say, truthfully, pot's probably the least of the problems. But yet parents have this peer pressure today where, you know, their kid says, I want a phone. The kid could be 5 or 6 and they just buy it for them.
Sure.
It's like a perfect
psychiatric drugs for kids, you know, and so I mean that's what I've heard. And but United States, they, you know, they do prescribe so many psychiatric drugs for kids.
Well, yeah, being a child is a disease now. Curiosity is a disease. Asking the wrong question in school is a disease. You know, everything about childhood has been criminalized. You know, free-range children, you know, where the parents could get arrested because their kid's out walking the street by itself. It's like a perfect storm.
Right. The only thing about the weed, though, is when I do counsel kids that are smoking weed regularly, I just see so many kids' grades dropping drastically, and they're just dropping out. It's really hard. You know, personally, I almost didn't graduate from high school because I was smoking weed daily.
Uh-huh.
And when I counsel so many other teenagers, you know, junior high and high school, I'm seeing that same thing kind of happen. And it's just sad when kids develop too much of a regular, you know, problem
right.
with weed. But as you
right.
say, before 18, it gets problematic, and it's hard to catch up, especially when they're from poor families that have a hard time affording college. You know, it's really hard to just catch up after that when you hurt things so much in high school because you're smoking weed so regularly. But after 18, Yeah, you know, not that I think it should be illegal necessarily, but I think I just wish people would do it less, because the more people are smoking weed, the less sharp they are to fight the forces that are rolling over us.
Right. Don't forget we have the other major problem, which is the true gateway drug, alcohol, that nobody talks about, and the damage that does to children's brains.
Sure. You know,
I've seen people who were heavy drinkers their whole lives, and they die younger than they should have. And the doctor will turn around to the family and say, you know, if he didn't drink so much, he probably would have lived longer. So there's another way of affecting people's brain cells. Listen, I keep trying to make sense out of what happened to the American spirit in this country, even with all the knowledge I have. And then, you know, watching a film like yours, you know, just adds to it. Aha, I get those aha moments going through my head. You know, when, I don't know how old you are, John, but, you know, I'm
53.
Well, okay, I'm on my way to the big 7-0 next year. But when
you
I was...
sound it.
Thanks. Well, I like to say my work keeps me young. But
good.
These past few years, I don't know. But I do enjoy the mystery of this life for sure. But, you know, when I was a kid, I would say the first time I was even subjected to it, or in any knowledge of drugs, I was probably about 15. And, you know, back in those days, there was only one kind of pot, okay? It wasn't like today where you can walk into a dispensary and they have like 1,000 different strains and different tinctures and this and that. And by the way, I do have my medical card, and we can do a whole show on that and the benefits of specific formulas for specific diseases that actually work.
Sure, good.
But as I grew up, and I'm watching your film last night, you know, I don't know if my friend was getting pissed off at how many times I paused the film, but I do that even if I watch a film alone, just so I could think about what I just saw. And when you started showing, you know, Timothy Leary, the hippies, you know, this and that, the anti-war groups and whatnot, I was probably at that time anywhere from between 18 and 20. And yet intuitively, I just knew that Timothy Leary wasn't the hero that all the young people were presenting him as. I didn't fall for the, you know, tune in, tune out, whatever his expression was.
Tune in, turn on, drop out. Yeah.
Right. There were lots of drugs. You know, I also made my living as an artist in my 30s. And, you know, being an artist in New York City in Manhattan, you'd walk into a gallery opening or whatever, and, you know, there were always private parties. There were literally salad bowls filled with cocaine, with pills, with you name it. Okay. And yet, for whatever reason, I liked pot. I never, ever, till this day, saw a reason to advance beyond pot. I like the relaxation that it gives me. I like the healing that it gives me.
Good for you that you never moved to the other drugs.
Well, you know, in order to appease my other artist friends who are all drugged out, listen, you know, yes, drugs do help the creative spirit. I'd be sitting there and they would say, you know, do you want to use this? Do you want to use that? And then one of my friends would say, please, Maria's crazy enough without it. Don't give her anything. Right? So I used to use that, you know, that weird craziness about me as a shield. But I always knew. And even when the hippies started to degenerate, which they did, I just felt totally disconnected from that whole scene. So I'm not saying that I was holier than thou. I just didn't get it. Okay. So maybe it was, you know, my own intuition saying, yeah, this isn't for you. Maybe I knew back then I had to keep a clear head so I could do this show for 20 years, retire, fall dead on my computer one day doing this show. But I did look at the effect that it had on a lot of people around me and the people that I knew. And somebody very close to me went to Woodstock. And that was the first time she dropped acid. Because as you know, I'm sure there was plenty of drugs at Woodstock. And years later, she died fairly young of a very rare disease. And one of the things I remember her saying was, I wonder if all the drugs I did caused this.
Yeah, I definitely could see that being part of the reason, though I don't document, you know, that kind of the long-term physical medical effects of acid and other, you know, other drugs like that. But in terms of promoting it so great, you know, in such a way, you know, I show, of course, how Timothy Leary admitted he was, you know, he was a witting CIA agent from around 63 or 64 onwards. Before that, he was just getting funds from a CIA front company to, you know, which 44 other universities were also getting. The Human Ecology Fund was, and they ended up finding that there was a CIA front company that was testing psychedelics on students, got giving them money, like the equivalent of $150, just to try acid or try mushrooms, psychedelic mushrooms,
right,
et cetera.
Or give them a bag of weed.
Yeah, so then Leary, you know, Harvard ends up saying, well, this is just too much going on at Harvard with all these, you know, them testing LSD with all these kids. So we're gonna stop this now. It's, you know, it's making us look bad. So they fire Leary and they fire Alpert. Is one of the other professors there was doing it with him. And so all of a sudden, who comes in? The Mellon Hitchcock family, William and Peggy Mellon Hitchcock. You know, from Gulf Oil, from Mellon Bank. You know, some really one of the richest families in the world, whose family members were. Had top post in U.S. intelligence, and they pretend just to be interested for, you know, fun's sake, but they give millions of dollars to Leary and start this group, the Institute for, you know, International for Internal Freedom or something, IFIF. And so all of a sudden he's got headquarters in, you know, half dozen cities for this group, promoting LSD all over the place, including Mexico. He's got a place in Mexico, you know, promoting psychedelics. And so then Billy Mellon Hitchcock gives his estate, is like 3,000 acre estate over in north of New York City, to Leary to hold regular parties and lure people up from New York City. And what was happening in New York City? You had all these activists that were involved in the civil rights movement going down to Freedom Summer bus ride.
Right.
It was the top place for the Freedom Summer bus riders, supporting MLK and the whole civil rights movement. And all of a sudden, a lot of them are lured up to this constant party with psychedelics up there. And who do you find hanging out at this 30-room mansion up there? I think it was maybe a 60-room mansion, but it's this huge mansion on this estate where he just gives up the whole place for about $400 a month. And you got all these MKUltra scientists up there just experimenting with various psychedelics, and all the artists and activists and musicians and all that were influence to go up there and check it out. And so that's part of the way. And then the media, of course, which I show, you know, evidence of how the media's not only, you know, overlaps U.S. intelligence, but also is, you know, shares boards of directors with the top defense contractors, top oil companies, top banks, top pharmaceutical companies. And Ben Bagdikian, the former head of the dean of Berkeley School of Journalism, yeah, said in his book, The Media Monopoly, how by corporate law, when you share boards of directors, you have to do right by your investors. And so you can't, you know, put things out there against what they're trying to sell. So, you know, these are ultra-conservative groups that are getting the media to be ultra-conservative and also follow through with some of these intelligence operations like MKUltra. So they're promoting, you know, inadvertently promoting acid also. Pretending like it's an underground phenomenon, but putting Leary in the TV spotlight constantly.
Right, and I remember seeing him constantly on TV, and I was like, ugh, why are they showing this guy? John, we need to take a short break. Stay with us. John Potash and I will be right back. Hi, this is Maria. I don't often get to talk directly to the listeners here on the Gary Noll Network, but I felt like doing that today. I know a lot of you really enjoy my show, but you might not know that I do 4 shows a week over at my website, maria.net. So if you're loving the show you get to hear on Sunday, come on over to my site and subscribe, because I've got hundreds of hours of great shows on pretty much every topic in the universe. And that again is maria.net, M-E-R-I-A.net. And now we can get back to this excellent show. Thanks. Okay, welcome back to the show. I'm speaking with John Potash on his movie, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. Check out John's website, drugsasweapons.com. www.thechemicalwarfare.com because we truly are under chemical warfare in America. Make no mistake about it. When you said it's chemical warfare on Americans, I had to agree with that. You know, when we talk about this, John, and I talked about it with Dave, especially on his book, you know, he talks about a lot in his book about the people in the 60s, you know, the 60s groups, the 60s performers. But you take this further, you know, and I'm not just talking about from Tupac to Cobain, but when you look at modern hip hop and how they tried to infiltrate that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, getting some of these rappers to promote Molly in their songs, and at the same time, what it, you know, as we said about ecstasy, how it was used against black South Africans during apartheid. It's obvious. It shows it's being used against black communities in the United States too, no doubt. But Dave did a great job with showing how the birth of the hippie generation can be traced back to this community in Laurel Canyon that was filled with intelligence connections, military connections, and you know the wealthiest families kind of connected to these people. And he pointed out some of his biggest analyses, you know, and one of the biggest leaders of that area of that kind of Laurel Canyon hippie party scene was David Crosby, said, from the Van Cortlandt family. He pointed out all his connections, you know, as well as the other guy from the Mamas and Papas, his name
was Phillips, now. Wasn't that John Phillips?
Yeah, John Phillips. It came directly out of the military and was using LSD regularly and promoting LSD like crazy. And also was, accused by his daughter of having sex with her for 10 years, which is utterly bizarre. But anyway, so in the Laurel Canyon scene, though, when I covered John Lennon, I showed how I started with that A.E. Hotchner, the longtime editor of Ernest Hemingway. He came out with a great book about the Rolling Stones and oral history of the Rolling Stones called Blown Away. And in that book, he says, assistant director of CIA's MKUltra, Robert Lashbrook, came to London in 1965 with loads of money, loads of LSD, and loads of agents, and instructed them, according to agents who confirmed this, to get LSD in as many musicians' hands as possible. And that same year, John Lennon and George Harrison are at a dinner party with George Harrison's dentist, and George Harrison's dentist doses their coffee with LSD, you know, it means they use it against their will without knowing it. And George Harrison, you know, didn't even know what it was at that point. It wasn't known well in England like it was in the United States. So I show that it's not a coincidence, and that's the way they got Lennon and Harrison trying acid the first time. The same way they an FBI undercover agent give Mick Jagger his first hit of acid 2 years later. But with John Lennon, he was so furious about it people wonder, well, why would he do it again then? But I show there was so many undercover agents trying to influence him, and some of those were in the Laurel Canyon area because that's where he ends up getting influenced by David Crosby of the Byrds at that time, you know,
right.
And Crosby still is a national, to try it again at a party with, you know, top actor Peter Fonda and other people at that party.
Right.
That just influenced him, you know, through party peer pressure, kind of as well, the Americans are doing, what's wrong with you? And so they tried again after that and was convinced that it was okay, it wasn't so bad. And so that's just the way it kind of happens. It happened with a number of these musicians. Now, George Harrison said in 1967, this isn't for him. It's crazy, you know, making too many people zombies in the Haight-Ashbury area. So he got out of it. But Lennon had, you know, got really influenced by so many people to keep trying, even though they thought he was making them crazy, he said. And, you know, to the point of saying that, well, maybe I should try tree panning to drill holes in my skull and, you know, expand my mind by drilling holes in my skull.
Right.
And he also was actually throwing up before concerts, his, solo concerts in 69-70, because that's what acid can do. It can hurt your emotional control with anxiety. And so, he was trying to get rid of it. Yoko Ono kept, you know, trying to tell him, no, it's, you're fine. It's not hurting you at all in a negative way. And that's too bad.
Well, you know, those were, John, those were the same years that, you know, disco was out. Okay. I don't even know if you know what disco was, but anyway, those were the same years I used to go out dancing, and we had some of the best clubs ever in New York.
Yeah, I remember the disco days.
Right, but that was when they first told us, never leave your drink on the bar. Be careful with your drink. Somebody might slip something in it, you know, especially
cocaine
LSD.
And roofies.
Right.
Yeah, and the roofies, they were Rohypnol. That was what was used against Kurt Cobain. Now, Courtney Love, of course, who I have in the film, has the most bizarre history known. I mean, you know, but she was showing the film how she was prostituting herself as a young teenager. She was basically, her father lost control of her to this wealthy family who's the Reese's. The Reese's, the parents had adopted Courtney Love's mother. She had Courtney Love, you know, as a baby with Hank Harrison. Hank Harrison says lawyers were bought out without him knowing it in a custody case when Courtney Love was about 5 years old. And so he went into a depression when he lost custody and couldn't see Courtney Love till she was 13. But by that age, she was in a juvenile delinquent facility, I mean, and saying, please get me out of here. And her mother had given up on her in some way. But apparently she had been getting counseling at ages vary on when she started the counseling, but they were somewhere between ages of 2 and 4 years old by different accounts, which 2, 3, and 4 is bizarre ages to get counseling. You don't do counseling when infants like that.
Right.
But she said with her counseling she was getting, and this comes from her mother's memoir that she was getting counseling at, you know, this incredibly early age, but she was also getting, listed the psychohypnotic drugs that these counselors or the psychiatrists that working with these counselors would give her and to her father in a letter, according to Hank Harrison. And she also said that her psychiatrists were having sex with her. Obvious, you know, trauma-induced sex abuse, which I show, you know, which is really messes up the mind. Now, I don't include that part in the film because I have that in detail in the book, but it's too much to cover in the film.
Well,
but
yeah,
film,
it just looks like she was groomed for MK Ultra.
She really was, sadly enough. And so by the age of 16 or 17, she's visiting her father out in Ireland where he's researching a book. He's a writer. But he is a writer and a counselor. But while he's doing that, someone befriended him. And so that person ended up being friends with, you know, befriending Courtney, apparently. And that guy ends up writing a letter on his deathbed saying that I was actually working for the CIA at that time. And so I researched his obituary, and he did die in the, you know, place at the time that Hank Harrison said he died. And so I verified some of Hank Harrison's sources on that. And Hank says that he admitted in one radio interview with Ed Opperman that he inadvertently set his daughter up with a CIA agent at 16 when she was about 17 years old. And that agent travels with her to London, where she's carrying 1,000 hits of acid, passes out like candy to all the musicians in the London music scene. Some of the top musicians, and messes up their lives, sleeps with tons of them because she was already working as a prostitute for the Asian mafia, believe it or not, at that age. And that's covered in mainstream biographies of her. And she admits, you know, prostituting, in some of these books, in her letters, according to, Mr. Rossi's book on her. And so, yeah, this is what she's doing. And this is her connections to the CIA in early age. And then jump forward to when she hooks herself up with Kurt Cobain, gets him using heroin daily for the first time in his life, and then when he sobers up and is going to divorce her and tells his lawyer to please, you know, take her out of my will, and he already had a prenuptial agreement with her, she all the best evidence is that she slipped him a roofie. He was separated from her, but he wanted to see his daughter, so she brought over the daughter in Rome. He goes, you know, into a coma. First he's unconscious and goes into a coma for about 24 hours when he's in Rome. The blood tests in Rome say he's got no other illicit drugs in his system but Rohypnol, and that was her prescription, her Rohypnol, which is a roofie. But it's legal in England where she was at the time for sleeping. And so, you know, she was obviously trying to kill him then, but failed that time. And so him having no heroin in his system a month before he dies, when he supposedly died partly, you know, due to his heroin addiction and depression, it's just all fabrication. And
of course.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting to see the man that was interviewed, that she offered $50,000 to blow his head off with a shotgun.
Right.
And then to hear the doctor say that he had so much drugs in his system, he wouldn't have been able to shoot himself with a shotgun.
Yeah, yeah, and put his drugs away in their toolkit and all. I mean, when you shoot up, when you, you know, shoot up heroin, especially this massive amount that can kill six people, it you know, people die with the needle still in their arms. You just don't even have time to put your drugs, your tools away, you know, put everything away, and then go pick up the shotgun and then shoot yourself.
Right.
You know, experts say that that doesn't happen. You can't do that. Besides the fact that Cyril Weck, the former president of the American Forensics, you know, doctor, says that he's never seen someone actually shoot, you know, try to kill themselves after heroin. Heroin's a pleasure drug. You know, it gives you pure pleasure. You can't shoot up a lot of heroin and then kill yourself. You're in pure, you know, pleasure. So it's just, it's, he says, most, he, and so I got him on tape telling Pittsburgh news team that he thinks it was a staged suicide. It was a murder staged as a suicide.
Right. Well, there's plenty of those that happen, that's for sure. You know, I think about the 27 Club in Dave McGowan's book.
Yeah.
But, you know, you brought it all the way. You
research it.
I like that you brought it all the way up to the Occupy movement and how that was infiltrated also the same way. You know, and that's another time I put the movie on pause. And I looked at my girlfriend. And I said, they're doing the same thing to the women's movement, trying to create problems between women that don't exist there, accusing them of things that don't exist. This is how they systematically hold back, whether it's the peace movement, whether it's the Occupy movement, whether it's the women's movement. There's always infiltration.
Yeah, yeah. No doubt. There's just so much of that going on. And, you know, the general theme of these things is they get undercover agents manipulating these people, such as these musicians, to inadvertently promote drugs, and then when they start resisting this stuff, they do them in. And but it's just, yeah, you see it all over in the Occupy movement. You got these police bribing these, you know, certain members of the Occupy movement in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. They're caught doing it. They give them lots of drugs. They give them, you know, offer them money and to inform on the group, but also mess up their minds with spice and K2, which is synthetic marijuana, but it's not even really marijuana at all. It's a constantly changing chemical formula. And so I've seen, you know, working inpatient at one point in my career, I saw, you know, people coming there on spice and K2 that his minds were really messed up by the drugs.
Oh, yeah. And listen, when that came out, I don't know, you know, where you live, but when spice came out, you could buy it in a smoke shop over the counter.
Yeah.
And it was cheap.
Yeah.
It was like $7 a gram.
Sure. Yeah,
and then people, the next thing you know, they're tearing off all their clothes and running naked in the street.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not everyone's affected that way, but right. A percentage, that's really worrisome.
I know, and they really go snap, you know, and I'm like, well, if pot was legal, none of this would be happening. But then, of course, they wouldn't have the same control over people, because if you're an adult, pot actually makes you think, and they don't really want thinkers. They just want you to tune in and drop out and maybe drop dead.
The, it being illegal, they also have used it to arrest so many blacks en masse and other people en masse, you know, and so that's another aspect of the way they use it to control us, for sure. But with Tupac, it's just you know, I show that him smoking weed too regularly, he had a bit of a problem. It was hurting his best thinking.
Right.
He was constantly under attack, and he was a lifelong activist. Mm. And so they did seem to get him a little off his
perceptiveness. His parents were lifelong activists. His father, you know, just went to jail forever without even any evidence that he participated in that crime. So, when you're being targeted, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's hard. You really got to be in your best game when you're being targeted like he was. And so it's sad what they did to him. But he was doing incredible work at getting the gangs to call peace truces and start getting involved in legal activism and stop dealing drugs. And that, of course, affected billions of dollars, because he was so influential around the country in doing that. And
right.
You know, New York's largest gang stopped drug dealing, partly based on his movement. And so that affected, I show the way that affected, you know, billions of dollars of laundered drug money. But, yeah,
it's interesting, and you've got it all in the film. You didn't leave much out. John, we're out of time, but I want to really thank you, and I want to thank you for the preview copy I got to see.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for talking to me about it. It was great talking to you again, Maria.
My pleasure, and keep me posted. I'm sure you're going to have more work ahead in your career.
Thanks a lot. So I hope people can rent it on the 29th when it comes out on Tuesday. Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA War on Musicians and Activists.
Yay. All right, John, we'll talk again soon. Take good care.
Thanks again, Maria. Take care.
You're welcome. Bye. John Potash. Again, drugsasweapons.com. So that film is released today, because today is the 29th. Actually, that's the air date of this show. I highly recommend it. I wanted to just close on one other little factoid in his film. The U.S. launders $500 billion to $1 trillion a year on the stock market. And there you have it. Thanks again for listening to the show. Share the information with your friends. If you feel like it, you have a subscription, download the show. Put it on a CD. Hand it to at least one of your friends. That's a good way to get them educated and also to find out about my show. Thanks again. See you guys next time.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.